Well, welcome again to Young and Old. Anybody's answer for what you're looking forward to this summer? The sun actually coming out? I mean, that would be good, right? Well, what a great morning. We've had a baptism. We've had multiple baptisms, missions report. In the back room right now, there's a senior adult appreciation lunch in which they had a rock, scissor, paper tournament. That was pretty exciting. All right, there we go. There was a lot of people learning how to play rock, scissors, paper, which is news to me. Anyway, I'm glad that you're here. Young ones, I'm glad that you're here, first through fourth graders. Thanks for being here. Okay, we're going to do something a little different as we get started together. Usually, we want phones in the pockets, on silent, all that away so they're not distracting you. But we're going to have a little competition this morning, and you can take out your phone if you want. You can either gather a little group, you can even gather a little group to do this with if you want. But I want to see a hand up as soon as you or people you're working with have the answer to these trivia questions. Boom, go. See how fast this takes us. Square root of 759. What is the capital of Bangladesh? And what year was the Santa Barbara mission built, established? How long is this going to take? See people talking into their phones here. Let me see. Any hand? Oh, there's a hand right over there. All right, stand up. What is the square root of 759? Okay, that's enough. We don't want to hear all the decimal points. How about the capital of Bangladesh? Bangladesh. Sorry. Oh, man. I stand corrected. Bangladesh. Yes. Dhaka. All right. And Santa Barbara Mission? 1786. Now, can you imagine if somebody walked in here like 100 years ago and saw that up on the screen and like, how in the world am I supposed to know all that? We live in an age where in less than 1 minute, we're able to have so much information at our fingertips that questions like this trivia is not a problem whatsoever. But do you know that information and knowledge is not the same as wisdom? We have so much information at our fingertips now, but it is very different than having wisdom. We're in the second week of a study of the book of Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes, as Benji taught us last week, is part of the wisdom literature of the Bible. Peter Kreft, a scholar that teaches at Boston University, writes this. He said, Ecclesiastes is the one book in the Bible that modern man, modern woman, needs most to read. For it is lesson one, and the rest of the Bible is lesson two. And modernity does not heed lesson two because it does not heed lesson one. What's he talking about? Lesson one is a lesson about what reality is like, what our need, our greatest need is as human beings, what our problem is. And lesson two, that which the rest of the Bible talks about, shows how that need is met, where we find true life, true meaning, true satisfaction. And so many in our culture aren't interested in the solution because they haven't thought deeply about the problem. Kreft goes on to say this. He says, of the 21 great civilizations that have existed on our planet, ours, the modern West, is the first that does not have or teach its citizens any answer to the reason why they exist. A euphemistic way of saying this is that our society is pluralistic and leaves us with the freedom to choose or create our own ultimate values. A more candid way, he writes, of saying the same thing is that our society has nothing but its own ignorance to give us on this, the most important of all questions. And then he finishes the thought with this. He says, as society grows, it knows more and more about less and less. It knows more about the little things and less about the big things. It knows more about everything, think capitals, dates, square roots, and less about everything, the big stuff. that wisdom deals with. And this is the point of Ecclesiastes that we're going to look at today. So are you in Ecclesiastes? Some of you are still trying to figure out where is Ecclesiastes. Most of you can find Psalms and Proverbs. If you open your Bible kind of towards the middle, you'll find Psalms and then Proverbs. And if you keep going right after Proverbs is the book of Ecclesiastes. And we're going to be in chapter 2 today. Ecclesiastes, again, is an exploration of the meaning of life. That is wisdom. And what are we doing here? Where can we find meaning? Where can we find purpose? Where can we find a life that is truly worth living? And to answer these questions, the teacher Benji introduced us to last week, sets out on testing different options. And today we're going to look at two of the leading answers that our culture gives us about where to find the good life, and that is pleasure and work. So that's where we're going today. If you're able, will you stand with me for the reading of God's word? Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Now this is the preacher or the teacher, as Benji talked last week in Hebrew, it's the Kohelet. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. And I said of laughter, it's mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart to know how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. So I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves. I had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. And so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem, and my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for my toil. And then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, it was all vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. And friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Have a seat. Keep your Bibles open, if you would. So, again, the teacher here testing himself to see what is good, where to find the good life. In his conclusion, he gives us right away, it was hevel. Do you remember that word? Benji introduced us to that Hebrew word last week, hevel, which just means meaningless or vanity or wind, something that cannot be held onto. And so that's his conclusion right at the front. But then he goes on to recount the experiment of what he tried. And so you'll see in verse 3, he tried alcohol. Maybe cheering myself with alcohol will do the trick. He tried, in verse 4, building and planting vineyards. Verse 5, gardens and all kinds of fruit trees and pools. And he goes on to describe all the various possessions he had built up, servants and flocks, money and music and sex, all of this stuff in an attempt to please himself, to gain satisfaction from the desire, fulfilling his heart's desires. You might say, kids, he had built his own personal Disneyland. His was the original Magic Kingdom, and he was the magician. He was the guy that reporters were coming from Architectural Digest and Better Homes and Gardens and Forbes and Rolling Stones. They all want an interview with him because he's set about to do all kinds of things to fulfill himself in these ways. But I want you to see something else that is going on in this description of his desire to indulge himself in all kinds of pleasure. There are echoes throughout of Genesis 1 and 2 that we might miss. For instance, he uses the words to plant, to water, to make, the word for garden, and all kinds of fruit trees. These words come to us in the creation story of Genesis 2. Not only this, but the word used here for parks or an orchard here in Hebrew is pardes. And we get our word paradise from that same word. He was attempting to build a paradise. Even in the structure of how this story is related, it's trying to get the original readers who have been reading this in Hebrew to think of Genesis 1. There's a sevenfold structure to this whole thing. I built houses, planted vineyards, made gardens, planted trees, pools, watered the forest, male and female slaves, possessed herds and flocks, gathered silver and gold, got singers and concubines. The point is that there's this kind of creation order that's being set about. And just as God created the world in these 7 days, so he is set about in a sevenfold fashion to build himself an Eden where he can be happy and enjoy himself. But do you remember in Genesis chapter 1, as God's creating everything, there's this rhythm of, it was good, it was good, it was good, it was very good. And yet, as the teacher here says, I set about to build my own Eden, the verdict at the end was not, it was good, but it was hevel. It was meaningless, empty, vapid. There wasn't anything that stuck. Look at verse 9 again. Here he's summing up the whole experience once more. And he says, so I became great, surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom remained with me as I conducted this experiment. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. There's another God-like thing, right? God, whatever he wants, he does. And yet, the teacher here says, I tried to be God of my own life, to please myself. I kept from my heart no pleasure, and my heart found pleasure in my toil. So it's not that he didn't experience any pleasure at all. Some of it worked. And yet the ultimate verdict is, then I considered all that my hands had done, the toil I'd expended in doing it, and behold, again, he says, it was all vanity. Meaningless, striving after the wind, something you could never hang on to, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Now remember, Benji told us last week that this whole thing, that phrase under the sun, is really important for the book of Ecclesiastes, because he's talking about life, just the physical world here, not taking God into account at all. And so as he tries to be his own God under the sun, he finds it just didn't work. Makes me think of the Simpsons episode where Homer says to his boss, Mr. Burns, he said, Mr. Burns, you're the richest man I know. To which Mr. Burns replied, yes, but I'd trade it all for just a little more. That's the idea, right? That as we try to please ourselves with all kinds of self-indulgence, it never sticks. Kids, have you noticed how for your birthday or Christmas that you ask your parents for that certain toy or game, something that you want, maybe it's a book, and you're so excited, and when you finally get it, you're like thrilled, this is going to be awesome. And what happens by your next birthday or the next Christmas? You want something else, right? It didn't satisfy you. You keep wanting new things. Jim Carrey, the famous comedian, actor, said, I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so that they can see it's not the answer. Here's somebody who has a lot of resources at his disposal, and he says it just didn't work. Now, even science has begun to show us how this is true. The man that you're seeing on the screen, his name is Dan Gilbert. He's a professor of psychology at Harvard University. He did a TED Talk with this title, The Surprising Science of Happiness. And in his study, he interviewed and studied two groups of the happiness of two different groups of people. One group were lottery winners. And the other group were paraplegics, people who had been in an accident and lost the use of their legs. And as he studied them, there was this surprising conclusion that came up, that there was really no difference between the happiness of the two groups. Now, yes, there was an initial rush of excitement when people won the lottery, and there was an initial crush of despair when an accident took place. But what he saw was that after a few months, the vast majority of people in both groups were no happier or sadder than they were before their life changed. That is, except for the lottery winners, who a significant portion of them ended up less happy than before they had won the lottery. The teacher of Ecclesiastes, in his wisdom, is trying to show us centuries before what studies are now showing us, that the pursuit of pleasure for its own sake can never produce the good life that our hearts desire. Now, you're thinking, yeah, that's fine. The pursuit of pleasure is not ultimately satisfying, but perhaps the good life comes through a more sober approach, through being wise and working hard. Maybe that can satisfy my heart. Well, that's where he turns to next. Will you look at verse 12? The teacher says, "So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fools walk in darkness." What's he talking about there? Well, as Eugene Peterson phrased it in The Message, he said, "It's better to be smart than stupid, and to see where you're going rather than stumble in the dark." So that's his point. Wisdom has some benefits. But look where he goes next. He says, "And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is hevel." It's vanity, meaningless. "For of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after the wind." You see what he's saying here is that death makes fools of us all. No matter how wise, how hard we work, the same end comes to all of us. So let's keep going. He says, "I hated my toil, my work, in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. And yet he will be master for all of which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity," right? "So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun." So he's going through this mental checklist, this mental approach of understanding the inevitability of death to all of us, the thought that he might work wisely, tirelessly for something that he can't keep. And the person who comes after him, who inherits, might squander it or ruin it, even worse. So he also notes that our work is just filled with frustration. "What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity." So after a long day of work, sometimes we just want to rest and give our minds a break. And he says, even that, sometimes you can't shut off your mind. It just keeps going. So whether it's the frustration of work or the elusiveness of sleep, the work cannot satisfy our life. Now, let me stop there for a moment, and just as an aside, work in the Bible is a very good thing. God works and God enjoys his work. God is the one who created all things and cultivated the world that he established. And we have been created in his image, which means we also have been made to be creators and cultivators to do work, just as Adam and Eve did in the garden before sin entered it. Work is a good thing. But like everything else, when we turn a good thing into an ultimate thing, it becomes not a good thing. The biblical word for this, of course, is idolatry. And that's what's going on here. I was reading this week from a man who founded the Denver Institute of Faith and Work. And he gave three signs that he sees again and again in people who have made work an idol. Let me just show them to you real quick, and we'll see if any of these resonate with you. The first thing he said, signs that you've made your work an idol, is if you're exhausted all the time. If you're always busy, always tired. Now, he also noted this is not just for people with like very demanding, highfalutin jobs. The same is true for an overscheduled second grader or a stay-at-home mom juggling some part-time jobs, trying to keep a household going. This incessant busyness and exhaustion that can just wear on us may be one sign that your work is becoming an idol. He goes on to say, fear. Fear. What if I don't get this done? What if I don't succeed? What if I fail at my job? Rather than through prayer, trusting God, we simply double down and we try to find our salvation in working longer and harder. Do you see how that just feeds the first sign of exhaustion? And then lastly, he said, is the sign of pride. Pride becomes not necessarily just when we find part of our identity in work, because we all associate who we are with what we do, but rather when we find our self-worth, our self-dignity, our self-esteem in our jobs. And this can come on the flip side too. If you feel a despair over your work, that's kind of a twin cousin of pride. That means we're putting too much value, self-value in what we do for a job. Ellen Davis is a commentator on this, and she notes how when our work becomes an idol in our life, it not only shapes how we see us, ourselves, but it shapes how we view other people too. She says, Koheleth, the teacher of Ecclesiastes, shows the total absurdity of the total work culture. And therefore, his is an exposé perfectly suited to our modern-day professional America, where many of us have learned to value ourselves chiefly in terms of how hard we work. In this culture, it is admirable to be continually pressed for time. And then watch this. She says, not surprisingly, we devalue those who are not economically productive or preparing to be so. So the elderly, the unemployed, parents who stay at home with young children. So the idolatry of work is destructive on many levels. Now let me just think with you a little bit more about these signs that work may be becoming an idol. I read a correspondence this week from a woman who described her life and her work like this and how these themes of exhaustion, pride, and fear work together. She wrote, "The phone is never off. Texts never stop. The work never ends. It's immersive. Work is life. And as much as we bemoan it, we struggle to know what to do in the moments when we are not working." Work gives us cues for action in life of what to do next. And thus, our work can undermine our relationships and meaningful church involvement. Everything that is not work. Even if we're not officially forced to work every day, the desires for advancement and financial security are such strong draws that to stop working feels like losing momentum in a competitive world. Now, can anyone else identify with that, or is that just me? I find this really convicting. I like my job most of the time anyway, and if I'm not careful, I can find my identity, my meaning, my satisfaction in my work. Lara has to remind me regularly to take days off. I'm not good at that. I haven't been good at it recently. I don't find it easy. So that's a little bit about me. Can I meddle with you a little bit? Do you have a hard time turning off your work brain, even when you're in non-work spaces? Are any of your relationships suffering because of your inability to keep work within its proper boundaries? Is your emotional life driven inordinately by how your work is going? If so, the teacher of Ecclesiastes here wants you to hear this. It's vanity. It won't work. It's a chasing after the wind. Now, let's look at the last paragraph that we haven't got to in chapter 2. Verse 24 says this. He comes to this summary. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have any enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give it to one who pleases God. This also is vanity, a striving after the wind. Now, how do you hear that? What's he saying? There's a couple schools of thoughts on how to interpret this. One is, finally, an oasis of some positivity in the midst of this chapter of just wilderness here. Some have read that those verses and said, what he's saying is, carpe diem, seize the day, live for every moment. There's nothing better than this. The problem with that interpretation is, hasn't he just said for the, like, all leading up to that, like, in just working to enjoy yourself and working hard isn't going to satisfy? There's something incongruous there. Others look at this passage and say, they don't hear him saying, there's nothing better than just to enjoy yourself. They hear him saying, there's nothing better. This is the world we live in, so you might as well make the best of the little pleasures you have along the way. It's a much more negative way of looking at this. It's like a consolation prize in a meaningless world. It's a chasing after the wind furthermore. But I think there's something else going on here. I think there's a third way to read this text that's really important for us to get. We need to recognize that the author of Ecclesiastes is setting up a way of looking at things from under the sun, but giving clues that there is something more beyond the sun, that there is a God who gives our life meaning. And true life is found in serving him and accepting from his hand, as by grace, the gifts he gives us day by day. Let me finish with a little story. You may have heard this story before, but it's a good one. It starts with a fisherman who's laying out on a beautiful beach. He's got his pole propped up in the sand, and he's just enjoying the great view. He's having a good day. And along comes a businessman on his walk trying to unwind from a day of stressful work. And as the businessman comes upon the fisherman, he looks at him, and he can't help but get a little frustrated by how passive this guy seems to be. And so he says to the fisherman, you know, you really aren't going to catch many fish that way. You should be working harder rather than just lying here on the beach. To which the fisherman said, well, what will my reward be if I do that? And he said, well, you can buy some bigger nets and you can catch more fish. To which the fisherman said, well, what then? And the businessman said, well, then you can buy a boat and you can catch more fish and you'll make more money. And the fisherman said, well, yeah, but then what? And he said, well, you can buy an even bigger boat and you can hire people to work for you. And he says, well, yeah, but then what? Now the businessman's getting kind of frustrated. And he's like, you can buy a whole fleet of boats and your employees will work for you. And then lastly, the fisherman says, well, then what? And by now the businessman's pulling his hair out and saying, you will be rich. You'll never have to work again. And you can sit on a beach and enjoy yourself and look out at the sun for the rest of your life. He said, well, what am I doing now, right? Do you see the hamster wheel that this is talking about here? This is what the teacher is warning about, this never-ending, never-satisfying kind of life in which we just live to satisfy our own pleasures. We work to try to please ourselves, and it doesn't stick. Friends, there's good news for us this morning. I want to give you a word of hope and joy, and that is this. The God who exists beyond the sun came into our world as one of us, and he told us the way to find true and rich and abundant life. He told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and yet forfeits his own soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? This is a paradoxical truth, but this is what the Bible teaches, that if you really want to find life, the good life, the life that pleases him, you'll give up your life and follow Jesus. One of my favorite quotes in any book that I've ever read is from Dallas Willard, where he says, yes, there's a cost to discipleship. You have to lay down your life, but non-discipleship has a cost too. Non-discipleship costs abiding peace, a life penetrated throughout by love, faith that sees everything in light of God's overriding governance for good, hopefulness that stands firm in the most discouraging of circumstances, the power to do what is right and withstand the forces of evil. In short, non-discipleship costs that very abundance of life that Jesus said he came to bring. The teacher of Ecclesiastes looks out at the life of self-pleasing, self-indulgence, self-work, and finds meaningless. But Jesus, the greatest teacher of all, says, come follow me, and I will give you true life. We're going to come to the table now. And at this table, we remember that it is not by our work, our striving, that we find true life, but it's by his work that he did on the cross for us. On the night he was betrayed, he took ordinary bread and he gave it new meaning. He broke it and he said, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way, he took the cup and he said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. As often as you drink it, do it in remembrance of me. He was pointing ahead to what was going to happen the very next day, where he gave himself. This was his work that he came to do so that we might have forgiveness, that we might be reconciled to the Father, so that all of our work might not be in vain. Do you remember at the very end of the great chapter on resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15? The last line is, your labor in the Lord is not vanity. It's not in vain. And so we come to this meal week after week and we remind ourselves of the work of Christ that empowers all of our life. We have a mission here at the church, and our mission is this. We exist to invite young and old to the truly good life in Jesus and in the family of God. And this is our family meal. So if you know him, come. You may want to confess your sins as you come to this table and tell the Lord, man, I've been looking for meaning in all the wrong places and pleasure in my work or many other things, but I want to find it again in you today. So let's come to this one who gave himself for us and give ourselves to him once again. Amen.